Hello and welcome to our optimizing digestive function part of the digestion module, the Clinical Mastery of the Digestive System course. I'm Dr. Rita Marie Loscalzo, and I'm excited to do this session because it's really helping you to pull it together. We have a lot of information in this program. There are a lot of different separate sections, and those separate sections, sometimes it just like all blends together. Like, what do I do and how do I do? So what I tried to do here was pull it together in an organized system so we can summarize some of the things that you've learned and then just give you a way to proceed. It's always nice to have a framework from which to come and proceed through a process. So let's just jump right in and begin. So before we begin, just make sure that you're aware of all the medical disclaimer stuff. You know, this is not medical advice, it's education. When you're speaking with people, especially, with pulling things together, it may seem like you're giving them medical advice or that you're giving them a diagnosis. You're always just assessing them and educating them about how to bring their body back into balance. All right? So let's just jump right in. Some of the stuff that we'll go through, you will have seen before, but you're going to see it in a different light because rather than seeing it right at the beginning when we first started, you're seeing it after you've been through the whole process, after you've been through the digestive tract top to bottom. And when I say top, as you know, we mean starting with your head. So it's head to anus, brain to anus, as opposed to mouth to anus. So let's just go ahead and dive in. So we have our digestive tract. We have a lot of different things that can go wrong. And your job when you have a client sitting in front of you who's saying, oh, I have this symptom or that, is first of all to figure out, is there an issue with their digestive tract? They may be presenting with digestive complaints. They may be having specific symptoms like abdominal pain, bloating, gas, but they may be having symptoms that are just farther away from the digestive tract. They may be having fatigue or brain fog or inflammation, autoimmune conditions. Know that anytime somebody's dealing with autoimmune conditions, it's most likely there's a root in the gut, unless they've already addressed it and there's still some other things that they haven't yet addressed. So most of the time when you see people, if you're seeing them for the first time after they've been through conventional medicine and haven't gotten solutions, they likely haven't addressed the gut. If they've been to another functional practitioner or another health coach, they may have already addressed the gut, but there may be still things there that they haven't addressed. So when I first started working with people and seeing people who had these chronic problems that weren't going away, in spite of seeing lots of practitioners, I was a little bit scared because it's like, what could I offer? But I found that because a lot of practitioners don't come from a systematic framework of going through things in a logical way, they were missing certain things. So don't assume just because your client's been to an acupuncturist or a holistic medical doctor, integrative practitioner, or a naturopath that that person has gone through everything and you're looking for a needle in a haystack. It may still be a horse, right? Even though it may appear to be a zebra. And going back to that, to make sure you understand what I mean, I was always taught when you hear hoofbeats, think horses, not zebras, right? We always look for that obscure, weird thing. Let's look for the obvious. Oftentimes, after we've looked at all the obvious, we start to look for the zebras, and some people do present as zebras. But just because they've been to a lot of other practitioners doesn't really mean that they're a zebra. They may still be a horse, it's just that the person just didn't go through a systematic approach. And the reason this happens is that sometimes it's overlooked that there's a digestive tract problem because there are no complaints, or because you've gone through and done some stuff and the digestive symptoms seem to have dissipated, but the others haven't. There may be still be a hidden infection or some other thing. I'm working with someone who has some ulceration on her leg, and it started out she had some psoriasis type lesions for a while we were working on. She ended up breaking an arm, going into the hospital, having to have surgery, put on antibiotics, put on all kinds of stuff, and those little discrete little lesions on her legs turned into these huge, big ulcerations. Her blood sugar got out of balance, etc. So we're looking at helping those, did some cultures, showed up with some bugs, working on that, but not really getting the process. And then suddenly her diarrhea came back, which we had, gotten under control. We go and we do a stool test and we find the same bugs that are in the infections on her legs or in her gut. So this whole injury, trauma, etc., hospitalization flared up some things that we thought we had fixed. So think horses still, go for zebras after you can't find the horses, and assume that there's going to be holes in the processing, and still start from your start to finish, top to bottom approach. It's very important. So these are all the different organs, the different parts of the digestive system. As we know, there's a lot that can go wrong, right? The person can have the leaky gut, which can come from years of eating gluten and other allergens, which can come from years of being in a sympathetic dominant state and not chewing their food and eating in a stressed out state or eating while they watched the news. So leaky gut has to be looked at. You've got to look at various and sundry things that can happen in all the different parts, right? You have to look, again, the large intestine, looking at the diverticulitis, the diverticulosis, the things like inflammatory bowel disease. Do they have signs and symptoms of those things? We have to do a differential assessment. We have to understand how all the parts work together, how symptoms in all the parts work together. We have a comprehensive digestive analysis. Always do that, regardless of where your person came from, and see if you can pinpoint symptoms that point to a particular area that might be out of balance. Do they have low stomach acid? Do they have H. pylori? Do they have a sluggish liver? Do they have cholestasis? Is their pancreas working well? And a lot of these things can be identified through history, through physical contact, and then, of course, through lab. So, just as a review, we talked about the three main functions of the digestive system. One is breaking down the food into molecules your body can use. Absorption is molecules absorbed into the blood and carried throughout the body, and then the elimination of any wastes that the body cannot use. If any one of these processes is thwarted, the digestion is going to be off. If the digestion is off, the rest of the body is going to be off because you just won't get the nutrients in to the places that you need. So if you're working with somebody on a particular problem, in a neurologic problem or an inflammatory problem, and you're doing all the things you usually get results with, and they don't have digestive symptoms, you need to go back and look at the digestion to see maybe they're digesting things, but maybe they're not absorbing things. Maybe they're absorbing them, but they're not eliminating and they're recycling wastes. Always think of it in the framework of three parts: digestion, absorption, and elimination. And the absorption leads to assimilation of the nutrients into the body, and it can lead to deficiencies anywhere in the body. So we talked about the ways of assessing the digestive tract. We start with symptom assessment. We do a thorough history. We ask the person questions. We ask the person questions about when did this first start? We try to understand what might have led up to it, what might be aggravating it, what might be keeping it from getting better. And those are really important questions. You can do scorecards where you do the questions, but you always have to go back and ask those specific questions, whether it be on a questionnaire or in person. Well, when was the first time you noticed that every time you ate, you got bloated and gassy and felt like you wanted to pass out? When was the first time you noticed it? Oh, and what happened right before that first time? Did you have any specific travels? Did you have any particular stresses? Was there a death in the family, a birth of a child, a move, a change of jobs? Right? So we're always looking at what happened shortly before the onset of their symptoms. That alone can give you an up on what most people are doing in terms of asking about these things. You've got to look at that. You've got to look at what makes it better or worse. That's going to tell you a lot as well. Labs, okay? We don't do labs right away, but they may come in with labs. And you can do specific gut labs that have markers of malabsorption, but you can look at your blood chemistry, right? In our blood chemistry module for an NEPT, for those of you in NEPT, we have very specific markers that would say, maybe this person's malabsorbing. Maybe their BUN is low. Maybe they've got low minerals, calcium. Maybe they have indication of low zinc, iron. All of those things can be had, and you might be suspicious that they have malabsorption. Several signs in the blood. And if you're using the Dicken Weatherby blood chemistry software, like everybody in NEPT has access to, then they'll be pointing those things out to you. There are physical signs. We gave you lists. We gave you charts. We gave you the ability. Poking on the ileocecal valve area, looking for tenderness over the rib margins, looking for tenderness where the gallbladder is exposed, looking for points on the body that are reflexes, shoulder pains, right or left side. All of these things can pinpoint areas that people are not absorbing properly. You can look at their fingernails. You can look at their nail beds. You can see if their fingernails look like they're not getting enough protein or minerals based on ridges and other signs there. You can look at their hair and skin and nails and look for signs of dryness and other signs of nutrient imbalance. And in NEPT, of course, we have a whole physical exam module, and I would highly recommend that you go back through it if you're not really comfortable with all those things that you can be looking for pointing out signs of malabsorption. Of course, you ask them about their poop. You ask them about their pee. You can have them take their pH. You can ask them, you can do the Bristol stool chart. You can ask them to look at that and see what kind of stool they have. They may not be experiencing bloating or gas, but maybe their stool is coming out in little pieces and leaving a ring around the toilet bowl from all the fat that's in there. Those are things that they won't necessarily tell you unless you ask. You've got to look for systemic signs of inflammation or allergic reactions, not just gas and bloating, not just doubled over pain in the gut, but what other parts of the body are having issues. You want to look for symptoms that are outside the digestive tract. Like I said, the skin, the hair, the nails, the joints, the bones. What other conditions have they been told they have? What other symptoms are they experiencing that could be tied in to a possible problem here in the gut? There's the main indications of digestive issues we went over, the obvious and the not so obvious, right? The obvious are things like gas and bloating and flatulence and burping, pain in the abdomen, hemorrhoids, irritable bowel, alternating diarrhea and constipation, or one or the other, a diagnosis of Crohn's or diverticulitis or colitis. Those are obvious that there's something going wrong with the gut, right? But the not so obvious and very common signs of gut imbalance are things like acne and other skin issues like eczema and psoriasis, things like brain fog, depression, anxiety, joint pain, people whose immune systems are out of whack and they get ill a lot, they get colds and flus, people with hormone swings, whether it's PMS, symptoms of menopause, dysmenorrhea, PCOS, endometriosis, uterine fibroids, all of that can be rooted in the gut. They may have signs of thyroid imbalance, big time. Leaky gut is contributing factor in thyroid imbalance. Headaches, autoimmune disease, allergies, attention issues, especially when you see children, but a lot of adults have attention issues. Asthma, fatigue, and fibromyalgia. All these things may have a root in the gut. So let's look at the way we can interpret these things. This is a chart that you have access to in a document that allows you to start tracking what's going on. So this is an overall assessment interpretation, and you can look at the digestive questionnaires that we gave you. And there's a section for low stomach acid, excess stomach acid, pancreas and small intestine issue, large intestine, liver, gallbladder, candida, dysbiosis, leaky gut, and SIBO. And what you can do is put the date that they started out with you and what their scores were. The scores on those questionnaires are always calculated as a percentage, and you want them to be under 10 ideally, right? So you put down their score at the beginning. And then you can rate it. Is it very high, medium, or low? Then you can start them on protocols, and we have summary charts we'll look at in a bit. You might start them on a leaky gut protocol, or just start them on a relax before you eat protocol. You put the dates in when you put protocols in place for those particular areas. If they are protocols like a 30-day gut repair or a candida cleanse, you put the date after and then you do the score again. And you can do this over and over and over again. And if you're not getting results, like say you determine that you think that there's a overgrowth and you work on their gut and you work on the probiotics and you work on an antimicrobial protocol while you're working, of course, on food hygiene, right? Chewing and relaxing and all that stuff. And you're not seeing a shift, you have to start to think, huh, what else is going on in there? And you start to ask questions and you start to reassess and reevaluate. This is a chart that you have the full-blown version of. I put in a little screenshot of it here, but I've listed on the left-hand side all the different tools that you have access to for helping to restore the gut. And across the top, I put all the different dysfunctions that you may be finding. And on here, where there's a dark green, it means that those particular tools are especially good for that particular imbalance. So you can go back and look at that. Okay, so when there's a light green, it means this would be good. And you could see that most of the stuff is going to be good for most of the gut. Where there's a pink, it says use with caution. There may be particular reasons, like if you have cholagogues, and cholagogues can also stimulate hydrochloric acid. So if you think somebody needs cholagogues, but they also have gastritis, or you think they have excess stomach acid, which is rare, you're going to be careful about using cholagogues. Maybe you'll do it, but you'll do it in tiny amounts and move up slowly. This is an invaluable chart. I recommend you print it out, and it's another one of those that you put in. You can put in everybody's chart, or you can just keep it for reference. Okay? These are important. The issues that we covered. We gave you protocols in the terms of done for yous, which we realized are not really done for you. They're guidelines, right? They're places to remind you of all the things that you should be looking at for each of these areas. So I recommend that you print off that chart we just showed you, that you use that summary chart at least for everybody that comes in, and that you have your done for you protocols printed out. You can put them in sleeves or just punch, three-hole punch them and put them in a binder. So you have easy reference to them and you don't have to be digging through all your materials each time. We don't expect you to memorize everything. You know, maybe after 20 or 30 years, you'll have most stuff memorized, but I still look up a lot of stuff because there's so much stuff going on in my brain that the stuff that I can look up easily, why bother having it take up valuable real estate in my brain, right? So low stomach acid, we talked about that. We talked about some considerations where if you want to make sure you're not giving them stomach acid if they have gut irritation, if they have a history of gastritis, because it may bother them. You want to do bitters and things like that instead. Okay? You want to make sure that if they have low stomach acid as a result of a lax lower esophageal sphincter, that you're careful if you want to give them peppermint or peppermint oil, because that can loosen it further. None of this is cast in concrete. You can always test things on people. So if you're suspicious of somebody having reflux and lower esophageal sphincter stuff, but peppermint, they have irritable bowel, and peppermint is so good for irritable bowel. Test, don't guess. Test, don't guess. And when I say test, don't guess, I don't mean just running lab tests. I mean test them, small amounts. I love to use tinctures and single herbs and nutrients when I'm first working with somebody, especially if they tell me they're very sensitive and they have reactions to things. So I can test each thing and find their tolerance. Maybe some of the other things we looked at were H. pylori, ulcers, gastritis, reflux, irritable bowel. We have those done for you protocols for just about all of these. Not that they're done for you, but they're summaries of all the things you can be looking, right? Looking at gallbladder congestion. We talked about that today. Surgical removal. We talked about that in our gallbladder and liver talk. Digestive enzyme insufficiency. That's a very common one. Very, very common. SIBO, getting more and more common. Is it really getting more and more common? Or is it just that folks are noticing it more? Small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, candida and other gut critter overgrowth, right? And we know that it could be something obvious like candida, and that's what people say, oh, I have a candida overgrowth. But it could be some kind of parasite. It could be a bacterial overgrowth. Tested someone recently. We thought maybe she had some candida overgrowth. She was thinking that she did. Candida parasites, fine, but she had some major bacterial overgrowths. And we're going to treat it much differently. And then some people do have the inflammatory bowel disease, less likely, more rare, but these are serious things. And yes, you need to be making sure that they're working in conjunction with their doctor. But quite frankly, most MDs give people horrific advice when it comes to inflammatory bowel disease. I had someone who came to see me. His wife was coming to see me. He was seeing me for his back. We weren't doing nutrition work, but I was doing nutrition work with his wife. And he went to the doctor from some bowel stuff, pain and all. They said, we think you have Crohn's. Here's the diet to follow. She laughed. She said, you can't follow that diet. It's going to hurt you. You've got to go see Rita Marie. He came to see me and said, yeah, my wife said this diet's not going to help. They were telling him to eat white bread, white rice. I said, well, gluten is the worst thing for inflammatory bowel disease. Grains are hard to digest, but they were saying because they had no fiber. We put them on a low residue diet. Yes, low fiber. We take them off the raw foods. You take them off salads. You make them steam things and blend them as much as possible and juice them if they're raw. And he responded miraculously, right? And so it happens all the time. There are specific herbs for that. We went through those protocols. So you can review. We're going to review today. We're going to give you overview. And then you can go back into all the protocols you've gotten, all the summaries that you've gotten, and work with individual clients. Are you going to remember all the different herbs that might be useful for Crohn's if you've never worked with a Crohn's person? Unlikely. When you look it up and you've got somebody who's got Crohn's or been diagnosed with Crohn's, and then you work with them, you're going to remember this stuff so much better. So optimizing digestion, okay? You can't go jumping into giving somebody Boswellia and turmeric and slippery elm until you've looked at what's causing it. Because then you're just doing Band-Aids. Yes, it's fixing. Yes, it's healing. Yes, it's giving the digestive arrest. I mean, it's giving the inflammation arrest. But if you keep allowing them to have poor digestive hygiene, poor digestive habits, it's like pouring gasoline over a fire as you're pouring the fire extinguisher. You keep setting the fire and putting it out, setting the fire and putting it out. We're about getting to the root cause. And most people try to overlook these pieces when I'm working with them. They, I'll do that. But give me the herbs. What should I take? They have to be calm and relaxed with deep breathing and appreciation before each meal. Otherwise, they're in sympathetic state. And in sympathetic state, digestion slows down and sometimes even shuts down. They've got to start the day with some kind of cleansing beverage to open things up. Even if it's just warmer room temperature water, they can add lemon, cayenne, mint if they tolerate it, but something to just get the digestive tract started. Water before food. Warm water better. If they drink a glass of lukewarm water a half an hour before meals, for some people it soothes and helps, so have them do that. They may need bitters 5 minutes before the meal or 10 minutes or 15. Not for everybody. Not especially good if they have H. pylori issues, but definitely might be something. Are they chewing? If not, they must chew. They must eat slowly. They must focus on the food and the meal and be in that state of gratitude throughout. If they're eating cooked foods, heavy-duty foods, and they're compromised in their digestive tract, until you get them built up so that they're repaired and restored and can create the digestive enzymes on their own, give them digestive enzymes. practice food combining or food sequencing. We'll talk a little bit more about that in detail later on in this presentation. But food combining or food sequencing is amazing. Some people don't need it, some people do. Food combining would be don't put foods together that require a different kind of alkaline or acid environment. Food sequencing would be that you space them and you sequence them. You have one kind of food first and then the next and then the next. And before you jump in and try to heal their large intestine, if their stomach is hurting, their stomach is not working properly, everything downstream isn't going to be, right? If they can't produce enough stomach acid, if they are not starting to break down their protein and their minerals in their stomach, downstream is going to suffer. So very much, you don't have to do this sequentially necessarily, but you've got to work on their stomach. You've got to heal their leaky gut. You've got to make sure that they have the right kind of probiotics. Sometimes you can't put them in right away, the probiotics, because maybe they have a SIBO situation, or you have to use certain kinds of probiotics when they have a SIBO situation. You've got to get rid of the pathogens, and you've got to get rid of the foods that are contributing. And the ones that contribute to the most disruption in the gut are gluten, casein, and sugar. Colon cleansing, getting rid of the toxic debris. We talk a lot about that in terms of colonics and enemas. When is the right time to get them doing things like that? And of course, supporting their liver and gallbladder. All of these things are going to be important. Every single last one of these things is important. And you can't like just skip over some of them and say, well, I wonder why they're not getting better. I'm doing a candida cleanse. Got to work on the stress. I love to show this to people. It makes a huge difference. I show them that when they are in the state of anger, their secretory IgA, which is the part of the immune system that protects the mucous membrane, what happens to it? It goes way down. Whereas if they go into that 5 minutes of care and appreciation, their secretory IgA goes up. This alone helps people to make a difference. When you give them a pre-meal ritual, this makes a huge difference too. So many people are doing all the right things in terms of taking this and taking that and not eating wrong foods, but they forget about this. I sometimes forget about it too because we're in a hurry. We've got other stuff going on. Don't let your clients and patients overlook this. Stop, look, tune into their heart, breathe deeply and appreciate every single time they put food into their body and every time they put supplements in as well. So all this expensive supplements and things get to the right place. This is my version of what I call the AM Gut Rejuvenator. Maybe you have your own, and each client and patient kind of makes up their own. I have people who put cayenne in. I have people who use orange instead of lemon. I have people who use apple cider vinegar. Depends on what's going on for them and what they work best with. Lemon water can help digestion because it loosens and flushes out toxins. But if somebody's allergic to lemon, you avoid it. Now, they may be allergic to the lemon, the juice, or have a bad reaction to it. Maybe they're okay with the peel. Limonene in the peel facilitates cleansing and detoxification and movement of bile. It's high in minerals and vitamins. They're one of the most alkalizing foods. And even though someone with a real severe case of ulcers or heartburn may have an aggravation with citrus, in reality, it actually can relieve the heartburn, the belching, the bloating. It helps to stimulate stomach acid production. Citric acid that's in there actually helps to maximize enzyme production. There's saponins and vitamin C that supports the immune system and also are antimicrobial, and it's very alkalizing. But if your client or patient can't do it, they can't do it. If they're adverse to it because they're not crazy about the taste, maybe if you share these benefits, they'll be willing to do it. Lukewarm water, what does that do 30 minutes before meals? Well, it can reduce appetite by filling the stomach. So when you're working with people who are overweight, this is an awesome thing to do. It warms and relaxes the stomach. So instead of the stomach being cold, it's nice and warm, right? If they love to drink ice water, that contracts the stomach and can reduce its ability. It raises the temperature, improves the immune system, improves the ability of the IgAs and other immune pieces to help to keep the microbes down. It can soften the stool and aid in elimination. And it's an Ayurvedic remedy for heartburn and indigestion. So simple things like this sometimes are, when you start them on something simple, before you get complicated, before you start taking away all their foods, before you start adding a bunch of stuff they've never heard of, start these things easily. Lemon water, lukewarm water before meals, and see what happens. For some people, it doesn't do anything. For some people, it makes the world of difference. Bitters are super critical for stimulating digestion, not only in the stomach, but throughout the digestive tract as well. There are some contraindications to using bitters. If somebody has excess stomach acid or gastritis, you've got to be careful that if they stimulate the stomach acid too much, that they get an aggravation. If someone has H. pylori, H. pylori loves that extra acid, so you may want to work on the H. pylori before you start stimulating stomach acid or giving them HCl. But other than that, the bitters can be miraculous. It could be a combination that they put together. It could be a combination that you can buy, like from Herbalist and Alchemist or Gaia Herbs or any number of others, and they can find the one that works the best for them. It can be just juicing some dandelion or some kale or some other bitter vegetables and just drinking that, or just chewing on some bitter leaves. It helps to stimulate HCl, pepsin, and mucus in the upper GI. So as long as they can tolerate it, they're good to go. It can stimulate bile, the pancreatic enzymes, and all the hormones in the digestive tract. We know that there are over 24 important hormones that control digestion. It can actually decongest the portal vein. And if they've got varicose veins, that can actually help to decrease the varicosity because it improves the return, the venous return. It can enhance their immunity and calm their nervous system down. And it can stimulate the parasympathetics and lower blood glucose. Amazing things can happen, and they're simple. The ones that are listed as bitters, some of these you may not think of as bitter, and others you definitely think of as bitter. Licorice I don't usually think of as a bitter, but it does have some bitter qualities. It's also a demulcent, so it helps to soothe and protect and helps to heal ulcers. There have been studies which show that it does better at healing ulcers than anything else on the market. Hops, which relaxes everything. We think of that as a nervine that relaxes, but it also can help with it bitter. Milk thistle, gentian, orange peel, dandelion, golden seal, Oregon grape, chicory, yarrow, and mugwort. Those are definitely bitter herbs. And there's warming bitters and cooling bitters. So if you're working with somebody who just tends to be hot under the collar, so to speak, or has that warm constitution, look them up and make sure that the ones you choose to supplement them with are the more cooling bitters. Most of the bitters are warming. Many of them are anyway. The one that I like from Herbalist and Alchemist has dandelion, orange peel, gentian, it's either Oregon grape or golden seal, and it might have milk thistle. So it has a combination. Okay, this is just a summary. You may not chew well enough. I don't always chew well enough. Remind people why. When you chew, the saliva moistens the food, makes it easier for the digestive tract to break it down, mechanically tears it apart. It's the gateway to the rest of the tract, and there's no teeth anywhere else. Sorry to say, there's no teeth in the stomach. Even though the stomach does a great job of turning and churning and twisting, it's not going to rip it apart. Think about it this way. If you put clothing into the washing machine and it churns it and turns it and does all that, it doesn't rip your clothes into shreds, does it? It just turns them and churns them. Same thing with the food. If you've got big old hunks of food that go in your mouth, the stomach acid isn't strong enough to rip them apart necessarily. The stomach cannot break them into mechanically smaller pieces, and you see bits of carrots coming out in the toilet on the other end, which just goes to show all that great food is not getting into the cells. So teach them, take your time to teach them about eating hygiene, about the importance of chewing, and how it's inexpensive compared to some of the other things you can give them and can have make a world of difference. So let's talk about some of the eating habits that you want to impart with them for happy belly, optimized digestion. Again, this is all review, guys. I'm just pulling a lot of the highlights together from the various presentations throughout our 18-lesson module. Eat in a calm, relaxed state, deep breathing, appreciation, chewing, eating slowly throughout, stopping between bites, allowing it to land, and then move on. And don't eat while you're having a stressful conversation. Encourage them to turn the TV off and put on some soft music. Encourage them not to talk about all the stressful events in the life. Wait until later for that. The other thing is enzymes. We know that the pancreas produces these amazing enzymes to break things down, the starches, the proteins, the fat, and helps to break down the fat-soluble vitamins. We know that the pancreas does that, but we also know that the mouth does it and the stomach. Okay, so you want to optimize the enzymes. You want to optimize these. And if they've been eating a lot of heavy foods and not chewing and putting a lot of strain on their body, and maybe they have blood sugar imbalances which strain the pancreas, they may not be making enough. So I like to put people on digestive enzymes. Personally, I don't like to take digestive enzymes. I'm not very compliant. Personally, I don't do it very often. But it is an important piece for folks that are not on a very good diet. Okay, this is another repeat. How do you optimize their digestive enzyme? Same way that you optimize their stomach function. Same way that you optimize overall digestion. The pancreas works better. The stomach works better. The liver, the gallbladder, they all work better at producing their secretions when the person breathes, relaxes before eating. Takes bitters 5 to 15 minutes before each meal. And that doesn't mean they have to do a formula. It could mean just picking up a piece of bitter green and chewing it thoroughly before the meal to stimulate the receptors under the tongue to say, hey, wake up, digestive tract. The warm water, the eat in a calm, relaxed place, eat slowly, focus on the meal, eat a lot of living foods. Or if they've got an irritated lining and they can't really take in the fibers, the cellulose, have them juice to supply those nutrients and enzymes. Of course, avoid gluten and dairy. We know that those are so important, and sugar should be avoided as well, as far and along with the refined carbs and alcohol. The probiotic foods, some people don't tolerate the sauerkrauts and the kimchi and the cultured vegetables at first because they may have a histamine intolerance, or they may have a SIBO, overgrowth in the small intestine, and those bacteria add to it. Find what they can eat. Find how you can supplement probiotic, and it may just be giving them a D-lactic acid-free probiotic at the beginning, or just a bifidus. And then the enzymes. Take them with each meal, but away from stomach acid if you're supplementing with it. Because if you take the enzymes with the stomach acid, it will deteriorate the rate. So food combining is something that has gone in and out of favor. And I'm not a big fan of it because it makes life stressful, but some people need it. Some people need it. And there's certain combinations that are bad. There's other combinations that are not so bad. Okay, and this is just a picture of a chart. You probably can't read it, but it's a picture of a chart taken from any site. You can go online and look up food combining. But sweet with nuts, sweet with fat is not good. So the dried fruit and the honey and maple syrup and bananas eaten with fruits or nuts, which means that all those lovely apple pies and coconut cream pie recipes that you may see that are gluten-free and dairy-free are not a good combination. You cause the fat takes a long time. Those sweets are there right away and they start to ferment. So instead, you can have people make desserts that use low glycemic sweeteners. You can use nuts or seeds that have been soaked or sprouted and use them with things like lohan, stevia, erythritol. Starch foods with acid foods or fruits don't always work well, just basically because of the acid alkaline environment. Starches don't work as well with animal protein because animal protein requires a very high acidic environment, where starches require a very high alkaline. Sweet fruits with the concentrated proteins don't work great. And then fresh or dried fruits after a cooked meal, because the cooked meal is going to take a while and those fresh raw or dried fruits are going to go through quickly and you're going to get some fermentation. So what is a good combination? Well, protein with vegetables, the non-starchy vegetables. So that could be, if you're a vegetarian, that could be a nut or seed pate. It could be legumes with the vegetables. If you're not vegetarian, that could be a piece of fish, a piece of organically raised meat with a lot of vegetables. My personal preference, and I see people get the best results, is when they go with the 75 or 80 20 rule. So it's 75 to 80% of the plate is vegetable, and then the other 20 to 25 would be their starch or their protein or their fat source. Fats go well with the vegetables. So avocado, nuts, seeds, coconut, they work well with the vegetables. Food sequencing is the idea of putting the food in so that it gets layered. There's not a whole lot of real good science behind it, but you can certainly go to this link and find a good article about it. So you eat the most watery food first, followed by, so fruits, because they're sweet, they go through quickly. Salads, blended salads, if you blend them up, they'll go through in 15 to 20 minutes instead of 30 minutes if they're raw. And then the raw foods before the cooked foods and the proteins last. This is what food sequencing, you try it with people. If they're having trouble, this may be the way to go. And always water 30 minutes before the meal according to food sequencing, not during, because it can dilute the digestive enzymes. This was a chart that I found that Dr. Stanley Bass, who's he's pretty old, he's probably in his 80s by now, 90s maybe, and he's been doing this for a really long time, teaches people. And he gives us these times. Water gets immediately out of the stomach if the stomach's empty. Juices or broth take 15 to 20 minutes. Blended soups or smoothies, 20 to 30. Fruits, 20 to 40. Raw vegetables, 30 to 45, et cetera, et cetera. You can read them all. Meats take the longest at 3 to 5 hours. So this is why a lot of people, when they move towards a more vegetarian or raw foods diet, they say that they are hungry a lot in between. So if nuts and seeds take 2 to 3 hours and meat takes 3 to 5 hours, then to get out of the stomach, that doesn't mean to get out of the digestive tract. So you've got to make sure that people are eating so that they don't feel hungry a short while later. But you also don't want to mix things that don't have the same amount of time, because some of them are already digested while the others are still coming in. Again, that same link I gave you before, you can find more about this in this chart. The healing factors for the stomach. Just a review, bitters, licorice. Licorice is demulcent. Licorice soothes and coats and actually has been shown to heal not just gastritis but ulcers. Lots of documentation on that. Slippery elm. People tell me slippery elm is their best friend when they've had stomach issues. HCl only if needed. Pepsin if needed, which is a protein digesting enzyme. Lemon juice or apple cider vinegar to help with the production of stomach acid. Black pepper, piperine, is actually a good one and actually helps heal. The problem is most people that have like an ulcer, it doesn't feel good to put the black pepper in, so you've got to be careful. Glutamine, chlorophyll. Now, that doesn't mean you're going to just come up with a protocol. You got to go back to all of the basic hygiene things. Make sense? We talked about the leaky gut 4R process. Remove, replace, reinoculate, and repair. You can't try to fix somebody's gut unless you do all of these. You've got to be able to remove the offending substances, the allergens, the foods that are inflammatory, the foods that hurt the gut. We have lists of that for you in the Done For You section. Any medications that they're taking that they don't really need. You can't take them off prescription medications. But if they're taking ibuprofen, which kills the gut, see if you can get them to stop. See if you can get them to do ginger and turmeric instead. Again, unless their doctors put them on the medication, and then you have to work with the doctor. You want to get rid of the bugs. Okay, so this is the remove phase. Here's all the things that can hurt the gut. You have that list on your site, the sugar, gluten, dairy, refined carbs, allergens, caffeine, alcohol, trans fats, heated processed oxidized fats, processed meats, nightshades, insensitive people, not everyone. I would say about 10%, 5 to 10% of people are sensitive to the nightshades. But in people who are tried everything else and they're still eating nightshades, that might be the place to go. Lectins are in certain sensitive people like beans and grains, and FODMAPs in some people. A lot of people are going on the FODMAP diet, which we'll look at it again in a bit, and it's in detail in your modules, and they're going on them for long term. A FODMAP diet is not intended to be done long term. It's to give the gut a rest, and then you start to test things back. But I see people who have been on a FODMAP diet for years. Not a good thing. You want to remove the unfriendly bugs, the fungi, the yeast, the bacteria, the viruses, the parasites, and the worms. Okay? Stool testing can be invaluable here, but some people don't want to spend that money, and sometimes you really have a pretty good idea of what it could be, and you can put general protocols together. In my consumer programs, my grand program, gut repair program, we have a generic protocol that's supposed to help most types of bugs. And it helps the majority of people that go through it. I would say 80% of the people that go through it see major results. What about the other 20? Well, we've got to find out what's going on in their gut and find the protocol that's going to rebalance their gut. We've got antimicrobials, so if you do suspect that they've got some sort of an overgrowth, whether it's candida or parasite or bacteria, here's some of the herbs, and we gave you details about these, and you can look these up to see what makes sense for your client. Of course, the stool testing will tell you. I did a test on somebody the other day and found all the usual suspects her bugs were resistant to. We think about oregano, nope, her bugs were resistant to it. We think about berberine, her bugs were resistant to it. Undecylenic acid, resistant. Caprylic acid, she was resistant to. The only two things she had were silver and grapefruit seed extract. So what are we going to do? We're going to put her on those, but we're going to alternate her so that she doesn't become resistant again. Really important if you're doing antimicrobial protocols with people that you alternate, that you don't do the same things day in and day out, because those critters are smart. They learn how to adapt, and they can do DNA changes that get passed on to future generations quickly. Not like us, where we have long lifespans. Theirs are short, and they just pass on the resistance to their offspring. And now you have a new species of ultra bugs. Okay? So these are all the things to look at. There are antimicrobial essential oils. Some of these work phenomenally. Carrots, celery, coriander, cinnamon, eucalyptus, oregano. And sometimes they get resistant. So alternate them. You can have people put these in their water, in sparkling water, in tea. It's a really easy thing, and people love them. People love drinking it that way. Well, what's the second R? Replace, right? So you want to replace what's missing, the enzymes and the nutrients. They've been eating a depleted diet for a long time. You get them as much raw and living foods as possible. Sometimes you can't have them eat it, they have to drink it. And sometimes they have to be off of it for some length of time because of the state of their gut. If that's the case, you're giving them enzymes. You have to give them enzymes supplementary. Okay? Fresh fruits, greens, leafy vegetables loaded with nutrition. Juices are the sea vegetables, the microalgae, the very high density. That doesn't mean the whole diet is this, but I'm telling you, this is the best way to replace things. High concentrations of food-based nutrients. Like we've heard before from people who do colon hydrotherapy, they say that they like to, when people do colon hydrotherapy and they're losing a lot of their nutrients, is to replace those minerals. Best way to do it is with juices, raw juices. Then the next R is the repair, right? Some people jump right into repair, but they don't take away the things that are causing the problem, right? Putting fuel on the fire, then expecting the fire to go out. No, it don't work that way. So we have to repair the lining with the mucilaginous, and we've given you lists of mucilaginous herbs. See what they've used before. See what's worked before. See what hasn't worked before. That's your framework. You've got a lot of tools that you can use, But if it hasn't worked for them in the past, maybe it was because it's not going to work for them now, or maybe it's just the combination. So ask a lot of questions. Any case, when you're working with people, ask what's worked before, what's not, what are their sensitivities. You want to be able to do gut healing supplements, anti-inflammatory herbs and foods. And there's a lot of them. You've got slippery elm and marshmallow and turmeric and ginger. Also, sometimes they need to give their gut a break. And as much as I'm not a big fan of non-real food, sometimes you've got to give them these gut healing meal replacements. There are some commercial ones available on the market. MediClear is one of my favorites because it's clean. MediClear Plus has a lot of gut healing in it, and it's got nutrients so that they can go off of real food for a while to give the gut a break. Here's the thing, right? If we have a broken arm, we have a skin lesion, we can give it a break. When we have a leaky gut and inflammation in the gut, we eat two or three times or five times a day for some people. And it's this constant barrage and assault. So if we can get people to go on liquid diets, blended diets, using gut meal replacements with lots of protein so their body doesn't have to work to break down the protein, it could be phenomenal. When I was first in practice years ago, I used to use MediClear Plus a lot. And we had people who just had such great results. There are now a lot more different protein powders on the market. Some of them are higher quality, but they don't always have the nutrients. So a lot of times I'll use one of the protein powders with vegetable juice. So they've got all that green nutrition, high density nutrition with the protein, and then maybe put in some MCT oil to get the medium chain triglycerides to support the healing of the gut, to get the caprylic acid to help to get rid of some of the gut bugs. Okay, all of these things are things you can do to repair the lining. All of these are in the program. I'm giving you a review. I'm trying to give you the overview. Here's a summary of the Demulsin herbs. They soothe, they repair, they rebuild, they're anti-inflammatory, they lubricate, they nourish body fluids and tissues. We also call them mucilaginous. Common ones we see are chia and flax, but some people don't tolerate chia or flax because of a FODMAP or specific carbohydrate imbalance, or because they need to have the chia or flax blended or it gets stuck in the diverticuli. Licorice, marshmallow, slippery elm, they're demulcents. They heal, they soothe. Comfrey I don't use internally much, but if I've got somebody who's not responding to some of the other, I may do a short term of comfrey. Comfrey is high in pyrrolizidine alkaloids, which can stress the liver. Irish moss is a sea vegetable that's very mucilaginous, and you can make an Irish moss paste, and you can make some actually quite delicious desserts with it that are also healing for the gut. Don't ever use powdered Irish moss, because what happens, the powder, if it doesn't have its full absorption of nutrients, of water when it goes in, it can start to swell. It can start to get into the diverticuli. It can get into the microvilli, and it can start to swell and cause infection. Not a good thing. Some of your common herbs like cinnamon and chamomile, very good for demulcents and healing. Fenugreek, jujube dates, which you can get at an Asian market. They're very, actually quite delicious. They're not sweet like regular dates. They're very demulcent. As about aloe vera gel. Most of the aloe vera gel, though, that your clients are going to buy at the supermarket or at the health food store, it's pretty dead by the time they get it. They really have to be eaten fresh, so I'd rather they get a fresh plant. But you have to be careful with it because it can cause diarrhea. Great for people with constipation, but go slowly with using the gel. Plantain grows in a lot of folks' yards. I found out that I have plantain. We're not talking the banana kind of plantain. We're talking the green demulcent leaves. Calendula and yarrow. Here's some others. Anti-inflammatory herbs, foods, and nutrients. Okay, there's ginger. I love ginger. I love turmeric, licorice, chia seeds, flax seeds. Some of these overlap. The deep ocean fish because the omega-3s, the algae and sea greens, the omega-3s, purslane high in omega-3, vitamin C, a supplement of omega-3 fats. Bromelain and other proteolytics, very anti-inflammatory, but be careful with somebody with active gastritis. Some of the other ones, capsaicin-containing foods, But again, precaution, if they've got gastritis, it may hurt. And also if they have nightshade sensitivity, it could hurt. Cinnamon, rosemary, basil, cardamom, chives, cilantro. These are common herbs and things that they could put in their foods. Garlic and parsley. Let me say a word about both Boswellia and quercetin. Boswellia has been studied in inflammatory bowel disease. I have personally had great experience with people who had inflammatory bowel disease and joint and muscle pain and had significant reduction in those symptoms with high dose Boswellia. You know, a tincture of Boswellia, 3 dropperfuls, 3 or 4 times a day. Phenomenal results. Quercetin, I usually see that in capsules. It's high in onions and other foods, but quercetin supplementation can be awesome for people who get histamine responses when they eat. They blow up, they get red. And I watched somebody do that, by the way, the other day. I was at dinner with them. I'm like, I didn't want to ask them if they were feeling it inside. They were across the table from me, but I suddenly saw as they were drinking some wine and eating some food that their neck and their face started to get red. Carminatives, what are they? Well, they reduce gas and bloating. The one we think about the most with that is fennel, right? It enhances digestive secretions, tones the digestive tract, reduces smooth muscle spasms, and increases peristalsis. But they're known for dispelling gas. Dill, fennel, anise, you know, those aromatics, mint, ginger, they're delicious. So work with people. You can have them just chew fennel seeds. At the Indian restaurant, when we leave, there's a big bowl of fennel seeds that we can take, you know, chew on them. That's what they do. Turmeric, clove, cardamom, chamomile, oregano, rosemary, thyme. You can look at these and you can see what they tolerate. You ask about their preferences and you jump in and get them doing some carminatives to heal. The re-inoculate, you got to be careful with re-inoculate. You want to put back the normal flora. You can use lactobacillus, bifidus, saccharomyces, boulardii, L-lactobacillus, sporagenines, and mixed strains. But you've got to be really careful. Folks with SIBO, you've got to make sure that if you're using lactobacillus that you use the D-lactic acid-free strains. And there's only 2 of them that I know of. Bifidus is very safe for just about everybody. I've seen people supplement with Saccharomyces boulardii or take a combination probiotic, and then they get an overgrowth of Saccharomyces boulardii. I've seen that 3 times in the past couple of months. Lactobacillus sporagenes, not a normal flora, but it competes with the bad guys. So it can be good. You just have to be careful about SIBO. And if you're getting mixed strains or the kind that are soil organisms, you do have to be careful. And feeding the normal flora with prebiotics is awesome. Fructooligosaccharides, inulin. There's a lot of foods that have those. Jerusalem artichokes, parsnips, some in jicama. But you've got to be careful if people with SIBO, if they're sensitive to those fructooligosaccharides. And I think, you know, the mistake I see people make is they lump everything into a category. Oh, that's a FODMAP. Well, it doesn't mean that people are going to be sensitive to all of that. And you've got to think about quantity, too. It all adds up. If people can't break down the saccharides, sure, they're going to get gas and bloating. So you've got to be restoring their gut flora in natural ways. But a little bit of some of these very therapeutic things can go a long way in helping. But if you have somebody who has inulin or erythritol or anything with FOS in it and they get bloated, obviously that's not something you're going to do, even if other indications say that they need it. It's a matter of looking at the person, not the disease or condition. The person, not the symptoms. How does that person react? I had one patient I worked with. She had been to a doctor who had said, yeah, you have leaky gut. Here's some glutamine. And they started her on glutamine and had her keep increasing it. And when she was increasing it, she was not feeling well. They said, oh, it's just a die-off. Keep increasing it. Just keep increasing it. She got to be taking, I don't know, 20, 30,000 milligrams of the glutamine every day. And she was feeling awful. She was feeling awful in her head. She was feeling anxious. She couldn't focus. And she finally just said, I can't do this anymore. Well, when I did her genetics, it turned out she had the SNP, Some of you might know which SNP I'm talking about. She had the GAD SNP, and she had quite a number of them. And that's glutamic acid decarboxylase. And with the GAD, you can't convert your glutamic acid to GABA. And with the glutamine, if it gets converted to glutamic acid, it's an excitatory, and you end up with anxiety. So be careful. Look at their SNPs if you have that information. I go really carefully with glutamine. I have people increase it. I listen to them when they tell me they feel worse. I try to differentiate between die-off, detox, and problems. And even if they say that they have a problem and you think it's a detox or a die-off reaction, you still back off and you go more slowly. You don't push through it. You don't make people miserable. It's not a good way to win friends, influence people, and get referrals. So putting back the normal flora, there are thousands of different ones and only a few dozen available commercially. When you can make your own food and get the people to make their own food, you get more. But again, if they have a SIBO issue, it might make them worse before it makes them better. The normal flora with the prebiotics, the fructooligosaccharides, inulin is a little bit longer chain. Bifidobacter ferment to make short chain fatty acids, which heal and nourish the colonic epithelial cells. Here's a list of probiotic foods, right? That one that looks gooey on the side, who knows what that is? That's natto. Natto is really an awesome source of vitamin K. It's used in traditional Japanese cooking. It's not made here very often. It's basically soybeans, or you can make it with any other legume that's been fermented and it gets sticky like that. Awesome source of probiotics, but also awesome source of vitamin K. You know, kimchi, sauerkraut, they're slightly different. Kimchi is usually bigger chunks, sauerkraut smaller. In traditional circles, there may be other differences between them. Yogurts that you can make from seeds or coconut or nuts. I like cashew yogurt, and it's really yummy and it's loaded with probiotics. Think about it this way. If you put 100 billion organisms into a bunch of probiotic yogurt, you end up with 300 or 400 billion or more. So you've basically stretched your dollar. So people love it when you explain it that way. I love Kavita. Kombucha actually contains some wild yeast, so you really got to be careful with people if they have a candida overgrowth. Rejuvelac, it's from wheat. It's fallen out of favor at a lot of the centers that used to do it because it's hard to get it to be of a high quality. Fermented soy, miso, natto, and tempeh. And even folks who have a problem with soy can handle this. I'm not a big soy person. I don't believe in putting people on a lot of tofu or soybeans, but I'm also not on the other end of the spectrum where I think soy is evil. I think fermented organic soy can be a phenomenal addition to a lot of people's diets. So don't make food the enemy. Food is the friend, and as many of the foods that are healthy and whole, you don't want to start eliminating foods that are healthy and whole. Here's some different lactobacillus. There's lots of them. Acidophilus is the one people most think of. Reuteri and Helvetica. Reuteri is great in the mouth, and it can help with dental things. Helvetica actually helps the body make GABA. So, you know, think them through when you're putting people on them. If they don't respond to one probiotic, doesn't mean they're not going to respond to others. Usually you're safe if you pick Bifidobacter. Be careful with the Saccharomyces just because when you go with too much of that, you can actually overgrow it. And here's some prebiotic foods. Check people. If these foods work with them, great. If they don't, then you take them out. Jerusalem artichokes, great in salads, shredded. Chicory, dandelion, gum arabic, acacia gum, you see that in some supplementation. Dandelion root, wild yam, jicama, love jicama sandwiches. Burdock, I love going matchstick sized burdock with carrot. Onions, garlic, leeks, asparagus, yacon. You can get yacon powder. I'm not a big fan of the syrups just because I think the syrup makes it too sweet. Use the foods, introduce them to new foods, have them try a food or two here and there, see how they tolerate it. Don't just hand them lists. These are all really helpful. Liver supportive foods. He's a whole slew of them. The brassicas, the citrus peels, all of these foods are liver supportive. You hand this bliss to them? No, you kind of feel them out and you see which ones to give them and you give them a few. When people see a list like this, they get overwhelmed. Oh my God, I can't do all of that. Pick one or two, have them try it. Pick another one or two, have them try it. Give them a recipe, have them try it. Ask them how they did with it. Tell people up front, if a food I give you to try doesn't make you feel good, don't feel like you have to have it because I said it was good for you. Your body trumps the practitioner. The body trumps the practitioner. The response in the body. You need to understand why they're having the response. If it's a positive response because it's shifting their flora or because it's causing a die-off reaction, great, but slow it down. Don't make people miserable. I'm not a big fan of making people miserable in the light of making them better. Here are the cholagogues that stimulate the flow of bile. The bile secretion strengthen the liver, enhance detoxification. There's a list of them on the slide. You've got that for reference. Doing that gentle 5-day liver gallbladder cleanse we talked about in the liver lecture. You can have them do whatever you feel are there, the ones that work for them. What's your favorite formula? If they have a favorite liver formula, have them keep it simple. Special considerations for living without a gallbladder. They must avoid the fried foods, trans fats, you know, margarine, mayonnaise, oxidized heated fats. Minimize or avoid dairy, avoid fats cooked with sugar, really big strain on the system. Reduce their grains because of the lack of bicarbonate from the gallbladder, which is supposed to neutralize the acidic chyme. Use bitters, lipase, bile salts. Be careful with bile salts. Go slowly with bile salts. Please go slowly with bile salts because you can cause them to go into diarrhea. Okay, small amounts, you can cycle them on and off if you want. Special diets for special circumstances, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth, specific carbohydrate, and FODMAPs. Let's take a look at those real quick. Review those. SIBO, small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It's really the good guys from the large intestine that sneak into the small intestine and start to overgrow. They rob of B12, of iron and other nutrients. They can damage the mucosa. They can deconjugate bile and lead to fat malabsorption. They can deconjugate bile and lead to fat malabsorption. So when people say they don't tolerate fats, it's not necessarily the liver and the gallbladder. It's that the liver and the gallbladder are doing their job, but the overgrowth is hurting them. It can trigger inflammatory cytokines and cause leaky gut. So this could be the underlying cause of the leaky gut that's not getting better in spite of all the glutamine and ginger and turmeric you give them. They can cause sugar cravings. It's maybe not the person that's craving the sugar. Maybe it's not an emotional eating thing. Maybe it's actually the bugs. They increase mucus production. So people may have mucus strands in their stool. And they damage. There's damage to the migrating motor complex. And SIBO damages it. And so it's kind of self-fulfilling prophecy. You know, you've got this migrating motor complex. Remember what that is. We went in a lot of detail in the SIBO talk. Review it if you don't remember. But it's basically like a peristalsis, but in the small intestine that moves the food and the organisms down. And when that gets paralyzed, we don't have good movement and the bacteria don't make it all the way to the large intestine. But remember some of the causes of the SIBO, the small intestinal bacterial overgrowth. It's not just a matter of killing those organisms. It's figuring out why they're in the wrong place. Was it the ileocecal valve incompetence? Is it the migrating motor complex that's not working properly? What's the environment? Did they have some sort of surgery in their gut, removing a part of their intestine? Some people have intestinal bypass or gastric bypass. A lot of possibilities there. One of the things that I tell people is that eating too often damages the migrating motor complex because the migrating motor complex doesn't work right after a meal. It usually starts working an hour and a half to two after the meals. So really spacing the meals out, in addition to being good for blood sugar, is great for preventing SIBO. There's a specific diet called the specific carbohydrate diet. It was originally put together for Crohn's and other kinds of inflammatory bowel disease. And the allowed foods are based on molecular structure. Monounsaccharides are okay, disaccharides and polys are not. But the problem is that a lot of the foods that are allowed on this diet are not good, healthy, whole foods. So you've got to be careful. The premise is that the complex carbohydrates that aren't easily digested are feeding harmful bacteria. But the other part of that premise is that in a lot of folks, those complex carbohydrates that are not easily digested, those would be some of the prebiotics, the inulin and all, are actually feeding the good bacteria as well. So it's really a matter of weeding through before you put somebody on a really restrictive diet. It's one thing to get rid of the foods that are harming. It's another thing to get rid of good stuff. So fermentable oligosaccharides, disaccharides, monosaccharides, and polyols. Polyols are sugar alcohols. Some people do well with them. Some people don't. Some people do fine with erythritol and terrible with xylitol and sorbitol. Most people do terrible with sorbitol and mannitol. They're short-chain carbohydrates that don't work well, then they're incompletely absorbed, same idea, and that they're easily fermented by gut bacteria. But on the other hand, we want to provide carbohydrates that are going to be fermented by gut bacteria. We want them to be feeding our good gut bacteria. So we need to create a good environment. So if you're working with somebody and they're not getting well with just getting rid of all the crap, getting rid of all the gut harmers, then you go to this SIBO or FODMAP diet or combination, or if they've tried everything, you've tried this, but I don't do this from the start. It's too restrictive. I've put together a SIBO plan, basically, a FODMAP low SCD diet, and you've got access to that, and I've taken out the crap that those diets still allow, because there's still some foods that are not allowed, artificial sweeteners, yuck. Gut-friendly foods, the green smoothies, the sea vegetables, lots of greens and brassicas to their tolerance. Some people's guts are a mess. They don't tolerate brassicas. They get gas and bloating from it. Some people don't tolerate sulfur due to polymorphisms. You're looking at food diaries with folks. Find out what they can tolerate. Find out what they can't and make sense of it through what you know. It's not always going to make sense. It's going to take some digging. It's going to take some detective work. But that's why they're coming to you. They don't know how to do that, but you do. Which herbs and foods heal which gut organs? Just a little summary that I put together. There's probably tons more we can put on it. And if you want to add to it, maybe we can create a spreadsheet somewhere. But licorice and slippery elm are great for stomach and intestinal lining. Probiotics are great for the large and the small intestine, depending on which ones they are. The fiber moves things through the whole tract. Cabbage has a special affinity for the stomach and healing the stomach. Chia and flax are great for the small and large intestines. Milk thistle is great for the liver and the gallbladder. The colon needs fiber, water, short-chain fatty acids, and good friendly bacteria. So this concludes our overview, our reframe, our review of how to optimize digestion. You've got a lot of information at your fingertips. Here's a few of the books that I've used to put together some of these presentations, foods that I like, foods that have good either recipes or protocols in them. I wish you lots of success with working with these cases. Stick with it. Be a detective. Know that the answers aren't always going to be right there. Sometimes they'll be right in front of your face. Start with the basics and then go looking for zebras. Thanks so much. This is Dr. Rita Marie, and I hope you enjoyed this.